You're listening to All the Best with Meryn Winchester. This episode, we're doing a bit of female loving and sharing stories about the female form as art, as canvas, as biology and sex. Plus, we're celebrating its diversity. There are some strong themes in this episode. To begin, we meet Megan Oliver, a tattoo artist at Innervision Tattoo Studio in Sydney. She shares her story of being a tattoo artist in a male-dominated industry and where she went to get a break and learn how to tattoo.
Hi, I'm Megan Oliver. I'm a tattooer working in Surry Hills at Innervision Tattoo, and I've been working here since about the year 2000, so I've tattooed quite a lot of the Surry Hillbillies in that time.
Tattooing is found in just about every culture in the world. The only cultures who haven't got any history of tattooing tend to be people who have just too much melanin for ink to show up in, and those people tend to have a history of scarification. I mean, it's a very, very old art form. When you think about it, in the old days, there would have been the cave walls, there would have been human skin. You know, it was around long before there was canvas or piece of paper on which to make marks. So I think we're talking about one of the most ancient art forms known to mankind.
I've always done art of one sort or another. My whole family are very artistic, so we were always encouraged to do art. I did go to art school, but I dropped out. I thought, it's not for me. I'm more interested in things like comic books, tattoos, you know, even drawing flyers for clubs and stuff. That was always more my interest. I guess I'm just a lowbrow at heart. You need to find somebody who knows what they're doing and convince them that for some reason they should teach you. So if you can show that you're a good artist, you've got a good portfolio of art, you've got a real love of tattooing, you know, and then basically you start off mopping the floor and making the tea. Eventually you graduate to making the needles and doing the sterilization, and you know, you hang in there for a while of that, and eventually you might start doing a little bit of tattooing, but generally it's a thing that you don't rush into. You know, all this time we're talking about the late 80s in New Zealand, and at that time you didn't see a whole lot of really good quality artistic tattooing around. I was always fascinated by tattoos, but I always had this arrogant notion, because I can draw, because I'm an artist, I can do better than what I'm seeing around me. And of course, as soon as you start tattooing, you find out just what an arrogant notion that is, because tattooing's not easy, you know, so you've got to spend a long time before you actually get any good at it. Oh, well, I didn't get tattooed until I was, you know, I wasn't that young. I knew I always wanted to get tattooed, but I was pretty fussy because I was an artist, and I didn't see a whole lot of really inspiring tattooing until I got over to London. I'm actually pretty glad I didn't get tattooed when I was really young, because I probably just would have punk rock bands logos all over me, which, you know, I mean, it's a page in your diary. It's not like I would regret it, but it's not what I would choose now. I actually was walking around London and I saw an amazing old building that had reliefs carved into it of, it was two lizards biting each other's tails, and I sat down and drew a sketch of this and showed it to the guy who was teaching me to tattoo, and he goes, yep, let's do that, that's your first tattoo. And it, you know, it still looks great. That's like 20 years ago now.
The shop where I was apprenticing, the guy who was teaching me, his friends all used to come out and hang out in the shop all day. It was really kind of matey, boysy kind of environment. And they were all so excited when I was doing my first bit of tattooing. There's actually a photo of me tattooing for the first time, and there's my head and the customer's head, and there's like six heads all crowded around. They're all crowding in for a look. So I was like, oh my God, I'm really, really nervous. But, you know, it was made easy for me because the guy who was teaching me would almost finish a tattoo, and he'd leave a little bit in the middle unfinished, and he'd go, okay, you have to finish it. So it's kind of hard to stuff that up. So once I'd done a couple of goes like that, he said, okay, you've got to go out, find somebody who's covered in really, really bad tattoos, and tell them you're going to tattoo them for free. So I did. I found a guy who was, he was actually covered in like really not nice looking prison tattoos, handmade tattoos, homemade tattoos. And I said to him, hey, do you want to get tattooed for free? And he was like, whoa, it's Christmas. Sure. So all I used to do was like colour in his old tattoos and just get a bit of practice that way. So once I'd done that for a while, then they say, okay, now you're going to tattoo your friends. And if they're still your friends when you're done, then you know you're doing all right. So, yeah, that's how I started out.
I mean, often getting a tattoo is a very personal thing for people. And, you know, whether or not they tell you a story around it, I mean, it's not like Miami where everyone's got a sob story, you know, but often it is something quite personal and it's something that's a real milestone in their life. And I've actually seen tattoos also really increase people's confidence in their own skin, particularly women. It's a really nice thing to see. They might feel a whole lot happier in their body once they've tattooed it. It's like they've actually claimed it. It's not just a thing that they have no control over. It's like their territory. It's nice, nice process. The tattoo industry here in Australia is in it's a very interesting moment right now, because they've just passed new legislation in New South Wales to say that all tattooists now have to be licensed. And you know, that's fair enough. You have to have a license to do lots of things. But the interesting thing with this one is that you were required to go down to the police station and get yourself fingerprinted and palm printed, which, I don't know, I find that a little bit draconian. It's like, imagine if they wanted to fingerprint and palm print hairdressers. You know, there would be a public outcry about that. And yeah, it's sort of a funny moment because there's all these new laws coming in, and these laws have been passed without any consultation with anyone in the industry. I'm not a criminal. The worst thing I've done in my life is get a speeding ticket. None of the people I work with are criminals, you know. I don't know any tattooers who are criminals. The tattooers that I know are artists. It's hard for us to understand why we're being asked to do this. And I think all I can say again is if the police want to arrest criminals, why don't they go and arrest them under existing laws? There's plenty of laws under which they could arrest somebody who's doing criminal acts, and I find it hard to understand why that doesn't happen.
Oh, look, you never stop learning, you know. You really never stop learning, and the whole field of tattooing never stops growing and changing. It really is an amazing thing. Like, I've seen it come up so far in the last 20 years. Some of the young tattooers that are coming up now are just mind-blowingly good. They're amazing. They're really getting, you know, the boundaries of what we thought was possible and just smashing them and just doing really, really beautiful, stunning work that is totally artistic. It's a really nice thing to see.
It's nice. You can bump into people 5-10 years down the track and they're like, hey, here's my tattoo you did 10 years ago. And, you know, it's nice to see them again.
Megan Oliver there, sharing her story as a tattoo artist. You're listening to All the Best with Maren Winchester, and this episode we have stories all about the female form. Our next story is about getting naked. I find myself in a cold, stark room at a boys' school in Sydney. It has that beautiful, shabby, chic interior only an art classroom can display. Old paint on paint, lino tiles, a mismatched chaos of colour. After introductions, a young male teacher ushers me into a storage area with shelves full of paints and art supplies up to the ceiling. This is my change room. It seems odd that the act of undressing is considered so private, given the circumstances. I drop my clothes to the floor, feel the cold air on my skin, and put on my robe. I wish I could leave my socks on. I wasn't sure if I should be here today, It's my first class as a model, and though I'm here to confront my issues about my body and how I see myself, I'm a little unsure of the young audience that will share in my own mini private revolution. Yeah, really, what could go wrong? It's just nakedness, the human body. It's too late to back out now. Here they come. An array of young male bodies saunter into the room in their unease, finding their places behind an easel. They look a little bit nervous. As I discuss the Renaissance, subjectivity, and the media with an artist friend of mine, Natalie Rogers, she explains the process and the purpose of life drawing.
Well, I think it's a process of two stages that can be thought of differently, but they can't be separated. And you begin to see the body more like a still life object. Life drawing teaches you how to see the world, to see what's actually in front of you. And one process of these two stages is the analytical construction. You go through a process of removing your own schemas from your gaze and seeing the body more of as a mathematically objective measurement and perspective. So just seeing things in three dimensions.
My body has been something I've loved, despised, fought with and misunderstood for a long time, both lover and enemy. I speak with another life model about her experience.
I was a model not in Australia but overseas, and I'd put on weight, and I'd come from this environment where, you know, an athletic body is not only a good feeling thing to have, but also sort of expected in some ways. So I had to sort of adjust my own evaluation of my body, and being in that environment where it wasn't evaluated in the same way was quite liberating. In this context in particular, it's a nice environment to be sort of liberated from some of those pressures and sort of, I think, slightly wrong thinking ideals, or even just to sort of remove your body from the way it's perceived in other contexts. Because one of the things that I like about life drawing is that in that environment, your body becomes a thing to draw, you know, an arrangement of interesting shapes and shadows. And what I'm sort of getting at is that I know that there's all this sort of body image bullshit that we're all subject to, and that not only is imposed on us, but that we reflect on other people. But then when you get down to just being naked, it's really not a very big deal.
The teacher asks me if I'm ready. I drop my robe and walk across to the podium, aware of the bits of me that are jiggling in the cold air. I feel eyes on me and suppress my inner critic. I position myself in a sitting pose on the podium, still trying to discreetly hide certain parts of myself. I wonder if these boys are comparing me or judging me against some ideal. Then I remember they'd have mothers and aunties and sisters as unique and unairbrushed as me. Natalie goes on to explain the second part of the process of life drawing.
I think the other process is about the authenticity of your relationship to the human body. So, and it's a sensual relationship. And you understand that figure through your own humanness, and referencing stuff not only from what they offer, but what your relationship to what they're offering is. So it's more intuitive and feeling-based. Unconsciously and consciously, you can marry those two processes, the ones of measurement and perspective, and feeling and intuition. And those dichotomies are old, but they're useful to think about, although within an embodied experience, you can't separate them.
As I look out to the young faces peering from behind the easels, I see the look of concentration. They're not here to judge me. They're here to draw. And maybe, just maybe, one of these young men is a great artist in the making. You're listening to All the Best and Getting Naked. Did I? In front of a bunch of 14-year-old boys? Well, I guess you'll never know. Pushing boundaries is not new to student newspapers, and student newspaper Oni Swa recently challenged the concept of a non-sexualized body in a very graphic way. There are some strong themes in this story. This is Vagina Swa, produced by Ebony Diaz.
Over half the world have one, but you don't see them very often. Perhaps in an adult film, or even a drawing of one in a sex ed class. They're mostly depicted as sacred, pure, and soft. But the fact is, vaginas aren't always like this. In fact, the majority of them are hairy or prickly, some have big labia and some don't. They're all completely different. What's more, most women haven't even looked at their own vaginas, let alone someone else's in the flesh. A few weeks ago, the editors of Sydney University's student newspaper, Oni Swa, decided to challenge this notion by putting the vulvae of 18 students on the front cover. They were censored, and a media storm followed. But what they discovered from the whole incident was something quite telling. Mariana Podesta de Vario is one of the editors of Oni Swa. She said the idea came about quite casually at a party.
It came about at a party that the editors were at about a year ago, so I think in October last year, and one of the editors suggested it, and that was Hannah, who was the editor-in-chief, i.e. the person in charge of the edition where we put the vulvas on the cover. So we kind of milled it over for a while, but originally it came up in a social setting outside of the workplace. After the idea was initially suggested, it became a question of logistics. So originally it was going to be one vulva, but then we decided to photograph a multitude, just have like diversity and stuff like that. So it came about in the end by just organizing the logistics of taking the photos and placing them on the cover.
Eleanor O'Brien was one of the students photographed for the cover. She's a member of the women's collective on campus that was approached by the editors to get volunteers for the project. Ellen said her decision to participate was an easy one to make because she didn't think it was that big of a deal. But when you have to take your pants off for a photo, it's only natural to feel a little bit nervous.
I was really nervous, mainly because like I didn't know the photographer and I just was a bit unsure. Like, I don't know, maybe it would have been worse if I did know her. But yeah, I just felt sort of how you would feel before like a pap smear, like going to the doctor for a pap smear. It's kind of like, what if like there's an awkward moment or I don't know. But then, yeah, like I just sort of thought, well, I'm here now, so I have to do it.
18 students were photographed. They went into the autonomous women's room on campus one by one, and the photos were taken quickly and professionally. But the biggest battle was yet to come. Oni Swa is funded by the university's Students Representative Council, the SRC. They have the last say before anything goes to print, and a bunch of uncensored vulvae on the cover was the last thing they wanted to deal with.
So we wanted to go to print without the censorship bars, obviously, but the lawyers advised the SRC president that that would be a bad idea and he would be personally liable. We started to place black bars, like the smallest we could get away with, on the cover until eventually we were told that all the black bars would have to be uniform. And when we went to print, the black bars came out much more transparent than we thought they would be, and more transparent than they were on the test paper that we printed out in the office, since newspaper obviously is different too. Like the paper that we use in the office was just white. Yeah, and so after they were censored, we had to take them off the shelves as well, even with the censorship bars over them, because they weren't sufficiently opaque.
The story was made, and the media responded well beyond expectation.
In the SRC office at Sydney Uni, hundreds of copies of the latest Oni Swa await their fate.
The hashtag Vagina Swa started trending on Twitter almost instantly. It even overtook the People's Forum hashtag that was happening on the same day. But it wasn't all supportive comment.
Are you guys taking expressions of interest to open a waxing salon at the uni? This cover makes you think you need it.
Oh my god, the nation's most extraordinarily privileged women have been censored for the simple crime of, breaking the law?
Although there was some expected criticism, the response was overwhelmingly good.
I think it's ridiculous that Oni Swa was censored. I was already amazed by how different all the vaginas were on that uni magazine cover.
The law censoring this cover is daft, out of step, and creates a culture of shame.
I had no idea that it would be as huge as it became, but I thought it was a really positive thing because overwhelmingly the way that the media interacted with the issue was positively, and there wasn't huge amounts of criticism thrown at us for being sensationalist, which is something that I know that I feared, and I feel like a lot of us feared as well when we undertook the project. So I think that in the end it was a good thing.
Student editors pushing boundaries is nothing new. It's a tradition of protest through university media that is being carried on today. Whether you agree or disagree with the editors of Onisoir, there's no doubt in the idea that student publications hold a unique platform where they can challenge notions that the mainstream press don't dare to go near. As a woman, I've learned from this cover that vaginas are all different. There's no such thing as a normal vulva, or normal labia, or a normal length of pubic hair. But on top of anything else, vaginas aren't just a sexual object.
Ebony Diaz bringing you Vagina Soir. You're listening to All the Best, where we're hearing stories all about women claiming their bodies. And it seems we're covering everything from psychology through to biology in this episode, so we can't miss out on sex too. The next story was recorded as part of the Wordy Bordello in the Rocks, where storytellers shared their tales of sin and virtue. There are strong themes in this story as well. This is Celebration by Edwina Blush.
This is a song that I wrote in 1987 because there was a very pressing problem for me then. So I was living in England. You'll understand in a minute. Oh, my river of lovers runneth dry. Nothing against Englishmen. My promiscuous lifestyle crumbled to dust. But hush, little bedsheets, don't you cry. I found a good way to deal with lust. Oh, you don't need a mate for sex to be great. Under the desk while no one looks. Oh, while you're studying the books, ignore your boss's boring babbling, indulge in surreptitious faddling, a little manual stimulation could greatly aid your concentration, cause it's the ultimate in safe sex, autoeroticism. Forget the health checks, pardon my euphemism. Don't let them tell you that it's second rate. It's simply marvelous to masturbate. Suppose your dirty clothes are soaking while waiting to do a little stroking. And while your salmon moves to setting, take time to get into some fitting. And if you're tired or feeling ill, ooh, ooh, it's an organic sleeping pill. No, it's not physically harmful. Give yourself love and body armful. It's the ultimate in safe sex, autoeroticism. Forget the health checks, pardon my euphemism. Don't let them tell you that it's second rate. It's simply marvelous to masturbate. No, you don't have to ask permission if you decide to change position. Pills, condoms, caps, and diaphragms. Wee, frisbee! Only the sick parents. Those reproductions outside. No babies there unless you're an hermaphrodite. Very clever. It's safe for the environment. Yes, it's the ultimate in safe sex. Autoeroticism, forget the health checks, pardon my euphemism. So grab yourselves right now and celebrate. It's simply marvelous to masturbate.
Yeah. Celebration was written and performed by Edwina Blush, and it was recorded at the Wordy Bordello in the Rocks as part of the Word Travels Festival. That's all we have time for this episode on Claiming Body and the Female Form. Thank you to Ebony Diaz, Edwina Blush, and all of our contributors to this episode. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN in Melbourne, Radio Adelaide and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Our production manager is Carly-Ann Keneally. Our executive producers are Jordana Caputo and Belinda Lopez. And I'm Meryn Winchester, the Features Executive Producer. Catch us next week for more homegrown stories from around Australia.
Show them that you can, but you can never rush your mind.